Tonight it's my great pleasure to welcome back my good friend Mariana Kaplan to speak about psyche and spirit. Answers are everywhere, but where are the questions? Mariana has, I don't know how many years, I'd have to think, but I know it's more than 11 years that I've known her, and I suspect it's something on the order of 15 years, something like that. She's a wonderful speaker, a wonderful writer. As this is actually my favorite of her books, Halfway Up the Mountain. There are a number of wonderful titles that she's written. I've been privileged to hear her speak here in this store before, and we're really looking forward to tonight's event. She's just moved back to the Bay Area, more or less permanently, I guess. And so we are happy to welcome her to Many Rivers tonight. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Too short for this. Give us something shorter. It's a small enough group, and we can all see each other. Thanks for coming. I was thinking about a lot of things when I knew I was coming here. I love coming here because they're my friends. And I'll tell you a little bit about myself. But the thing that I was thinking about today when I was thinking about coming here was... Oh, hi. Coming out of the woodwork. The last time that I spoke here, I was like, because I've been up here a lot, and I live in Fairfax. And the last time I came here was about, I think it was the night after the U.S. invaded Iraq, a few years ago? And it was an intense time. I mean, everyone was kind of, it was really intense. It wasn't like 9/11, but it was really strong. And I thought, wow, does anybody want to come to a talk? And should I be doing a talk? And I was doing a talk in somebody else's book that I had written a foreword for, but a shared experience. It was about a great saint in South India. That it was a biography of him, and this woman lived a very private life, so I was giving the talk. And we spent all evening telling stories about what a real saint, what the expressions of a real saint, and it was so beautiful and intimate and healing. And so I was thinking about that. So the main reason I'm here is because Robin Stewart asked me to come. I'm in a more kind of cocoon, private part of my work life where I'm not really having much need to listen to myself talk. But of course, I love the Dharma, as I'm sure everyone here does. So I'll introduce myself a little bit, but I'd be interested to know, like I would be satisfied at the end of tonight if I could do something that was satisfying to some people here with all, whatever knowledge I have. So I might ask you in a few minutes what you're coming here with, so hopefully we can weave it in. So why would I be here? Because I've written a bunch of books, a lot about the subject of psychology and spirituality, and the focus of my work is really about the integration of the two. There's other focuses, but that's where my intention is now. I'm finishing a book that'll come out next year, and that's just the subject that I keep going into, and the role of the body and all of that. And so that'll be the general frame that we'll work on, and a little subdivision of that ends up being about obstacles and self-deception on the spiritual path, and I'll just bracket that off. It will come up. I've been teaching transpersonal psychology for many years, and because of the nature of the books I've written, a lot of them have included interviews with great masters and psychologists and scholars east and west. And before I was settling down as of last week, I've traveled the world and interviewed and met all these people and talked to them and taken it in and synthesized and written about it. And for my own learning, I wanted to know what all these people knew, and that was my pleasure. You know, like some people go look for a new mountain, and I look for like a new, I wanted to find like the new Carl Jung, or, you know, like, where's, you know, the new, like, not for the sake of saint hopping, because I've had a teacher for many years, but because I think we're all looking for our own synthesis and how to live optimally and how to integrate knowledge. And we may have a path, but still it's our own process and our unique synthesis that's going on. So now I'm actually just interested in the process of synthesis. And I don't, like, it doesn't matter to me what path someone's on, or if they're eclectic, or I don't think there's a right path or a wrong path, but I'm interested in helping people make distinctions, because it's so complex, dealing not only with spirit, but the psyche. It's just so complex. So just articulating the questions and the distinctions and sorting through it all. I'm finishing my training as a psychotherapist. I've worked for 10 years as a psychotherapist, but I never got licensed. So I found that, like, in years and years in the spiritual path and meditation and yoga and the whole bit, like, I'm studying psychology again, but not the psychology that you might find from some therapist who goes through a 2-year program and has never had to be in psychotherapy and does all this chatty stuff, which is most of psychotherapy. But one little sub point before I ask you why you came here is that people in the spiritual scene will diss psychology a lot, and people in the psychological world will discount spirituality. But my take on psychology is that it's about 100 years old in Western psychology, you know, plus 110. And that's really young for a new discipline. It's a baby. Like, Abhidharma Buddhist psychology developed over thousands of years, and Sufi psychology over thousands of years, and the Hindu pantheon is like this map of the psyche and thousands of years, and we're just 100 years into it. And I think that a psychology that is suitable to the Western psyche, but that draws on the context of all the accessibility we have to these beautiful Eastern traditions, is just in its inception. And probably the psychology that I want to see won't happen in my lifetime, but bits of it will. So that's a lot of what I'm interested in. And the reason that I'm interested in it is because I mean, these guys have watched me grow up, because I was a little kid when we met, and I've spent my whole adult life practicing in India, interviewing and writing, studying, and kind of keeping a pulse on the spiritual scene because of my job to write about it. And what I see is that the place that most of the spiritual scandals and the place that, like having great experiences, great mystical experiences and revelations, it's not easy, but it's not that hard to come by. I mean, whatever your medium of doing that is, through intense meditation or a shocking experience or drugs or sex or whatever, like, you can come across those kinds of experiences. But where people get stuck in the path and frustrated is in the psychological part of their being, like how those experiences integrate into the, like, little details of our daily life and our health and our relationships and our emotions, just dealing with our emotions on any given day. So that's where the scandals come. Like, spiritual teachers have scandals because they haven't worked out their issues. Like, 90% of the scandals, they haven't worked out their issues in relationship to mommy, daddy, sex, power. That's where the scandals come, and big breakdowns happen because of money, power, sex, and essentially mommy, daddy issues. So really profoundly realized people, but there's these psychological issues. So I risk, especially when I write the new book, all these hardcore spiritual people are gonna like give me all the arguments about psychology and duality and how it's unreal, and I'm like, I'll be ready by the time the book comes out, because I don't agree. So that's some of the material I'll probably get into tonight. But I'm happy if we end up chatting, or your questions. Let's maybe you could tell me, some people, like, why you're here, what you'd love to talk about tonight. Go from there.
I'll ask a question, because it's one that I've been interested in along the lines of what you're describing. And you've talked about an integration of the psychological and the spiritual. Can you give some sense of how you frame those things as different in order to, like, set up the grounds for a synthesis?
Yep. Can I bookmark that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I was planning to do, but yeah, that's critical for our conversation. And the body.
That was my question. How do you bring the body into it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm just working on all this, but, you know, I'm the one sitting here, but we're just working it out. So I'm not claiming, you know, I'm working hard on these things in myself, but just throwing out some ideas.
I haven't seen anybody walk through the door a foot off the ground yet.
You're
in good company.
Yeah. Yeah. Other people, what brought you in tonight?
I have been interested in the non-dual teachings, like Adyashanti and those teachers, the last couple of years, and some of those teachers say we're already enlightened. You know, everybody's enlightened. Just wake up to enlightenment. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So that is, you know, when you take that in, it's like, wow, yeah. You know, it's a real, yeah, I don't have to sit on my cushion anymore.
Mm.
don't have to read these books or anything. And I guess I have the sense that there is a grain of truth in that, and that approach can also just be jumping over a lot of truths that have been laid down through the years, through different teachings. So I was interested in
that. Yeah, that's like my favorite subject, spiritual bypassing.
Oh.
Yeah, well, thank you, we'll talk about that. And then if we don't get to it, like I'm taking some inventory, just remind me. Great, thanks.
I'm curious about the halfway up the mountain title.
Mm.
And we would like for you to expand on that.
Okay. Great. I'm going to have to take some notes. Yeah.
I've become more comfortable, more relaxed about my Buddhist background. Traditional Buddhism, they talk about this journey taking many, many, many lifetimes, eons.
Mm-hmm.
I've become very comfortable with that perspective. You know, like when I was younger, I wanted to do it 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I find it to be, you know, like opening and more, I don't know, just, I feel good with that perspective, and I'm wondering if you have more perspective
or
comments about that traditional view of this world. Mm. Mm.
Great. Thanks.
Well, I applaud your firmness in sticking with what you believe with regards to the mommy daddy issues, and I just want to hear how you're gonna
not partake in.
I found in my life experience, I found how it's easy sometimes to just flow over into the spiritual part, never really discounting or forgetting the psychological part, but just floating into that and then going back into the psychological.
Yeah.
And it's there's no separation from the way they.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Mm.
I can't hear you.
If you don't want to sit in the middle, you can make you a seat over here.
Yeah, thank you. I've just been changing the oil with my son. It was just such an expansive experience. I was afraid I might lose fragrance.
Motor oil.
Pretty much. I have to be back for it. All right, I think I'm going to stop asking for questions because I don't know how much time we're going to have. I don't feel bad that I didn't get to everybody. So we'll start with this and go from there. Or is there anything else that, that you're wanting? It's not the only opportunity.
What's the book title of your new book?
That I'm not going to answer because it's really in process. But it's more of the same.
So the theme is, of the new book is?
Discernment. Yeah, discernment and the spiritual path. And psychology and spirituality and all this stuff. Just like 10 years later, you know, chipping away hey, let's do Halfway Up the Mountain because that's a... We'll do Halfway Up the Mountain, the title, and then we'll make some distinctions in psychology and spirituality. I mentioned the body and then go from there. Plan? So I was writing this book, I was writing that book, Halfway Up the Mountain, and I was very young and I was going around the country interviewing all these people I never even thought that I would meet. And I was up in Denver interviewing this guy named Damon Henry, who's the main Roshi of the Denver Zen Center. But he has a big fourth way background, for those people that means something to. And he was telling me a story, but he was a Zen student before that, with Philip Keplow. He started young, and he was a Zen student, and then he did fourth way, and then he came back to Zen. Something like that. So anyway... he was telling me the story about when he was a young Zen student, because I was working on this title. It was called Jumping the Gun, and it was basically about people who like have these big experiences and think they're enlightened, and it's way premature. And that was a title, okay, but I don't really want gun in the title of one of my books. I just could do it some other way. And so he's telling me this story, and he said that when he was doing sesshin, like his first long sesshin with Philip Keplow, who was a really intense teacher, Zen teacher with the whole stick and everything, and he hit his first satori, and he went in. They would have these dokusan, these interviews, and he went into dokusan, and he was like, "Wow! Like I got it! I got it! I saw it, and emptiness, and you know, no separation. The whole works." Like is so commonly spoken in these parts of the world, and. And Kapla Roshi was like, "Oh, that's very good. Go back to your cushion, and we'll check in a few days." And so he went, and then it was like all changing and going techno and amazing and deities, the works. And he went back in, and he was like, "Really, Roshi? Like, I got it, you know? Like, acknowledge me," was, I'm sure, the mood. Acknowledge my spiritual grandeur. And Roshi was like, "Yeah, it's very good. You just go." He had Danim was working on the Koan Mu. So he's like, "Just go back to Mu and stay." And apparently he dared to go in a few days later and give the same thing. And it was like, "It's gotten bigger." And then Kepler Roshi just went down on him. And he was like, he just railed on him and said, so Danim was telling a story, you know. You are wasting my time being here. You are taking a good cushion in our Zendo. And if you want to stop halfway up the mountain, like, be my guest, but don't waste our space and our time. And, like, you're excused." And so Danon, you know, he's probably like 23 at the time. And he said to me, he said probably because I was just so scared of him. He said he was really a leathery warrior is what he told me. He said I went back and just started working on Mu, and he started experiencing when he stopped like going out and tripping out on his states and just started focusing on his task. He said that they're basically begun a process that would, over many, many, many years, help him to start to acquaint with, like, the ground of his being. And I can't remember his words because the book's kind of old. But it's a really nice story. So I went back and was telling my teacher this story. And it's Halfway Up the Mountain. And as soon as I said it, we were like, Halfway Up the Mountain. The title's arrived. God, they're stubborn, those titles sometimes. So, it is my deep belief that ultimately, when psychology becomes what it can be, it won't be separate from spirituality. And, I mean, I see them as like these intertwined, like, lovers, really. But in today's world, they are quite separate. And I think it's very practical to separate them out because there's different processes. It's like ultimately they come together like lovers, but they're also they're different different functions. And so I'll give you a few different hopefully simple metaphors and paradigms, and because different ones work for different people. When I teach transpersonal psychology, we talk about the context of consciousness and the content of consciousness. So the context of consciousness, it's the context of everything. It's the ground from which everything emerges. It's like if you're like have a big awakening experience and you're connected to this, like what we'll often call consciousness and oneness and ground of being. So emptiness, void, Shiva in the Hindu pantheon, Shiva's the ground, and Shakti is manifestation, which would be more like psychology. So it's like it's consciousness itself, the ground from which all manifestation will arise. And then if we transpose this, these are just metaphors, right? Just kind of looking at general directions and context, and then the content of consciousness would be like what actually happens inside of that. So my own human psyche, my history, my story, I think real psychology deals with your ancestry, and there's all this wonderful family constellation work that's coming now, because it's not just my story, it's actually the story of the psyche, of my lineage, and of my culture, and of my immigration, and of the culture that I'm in now, and the time that we're living in, and the interrelationships, and it's so much. It's the content of that we're dealing with. And if you were a reincarnation person, like it would be like what you're working with in this lifetime, is a lot of content of consciousness. That's one way. So Zen, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but it would be like the spirituality would be the emptiness, and the psychology would be in the domain of form. And yeah, Shiva Shakti, or they also do Purusha and Prakriti in yoga and Ayurveda. Or duality and non-duality, basically. The non-dual is essentially the domain of the spiritual. We could argue any of this, but basically we're just making like... So the non-dual would be spirituality, and the dual would be the psyche. So someone who is on a non-dual like high horse and didn't like psychology would say that the psychology is just, it's all about your story, and it's ultimately unreal because it's, you know, it's just, where is it, and the whole thing. I mean, I could do like the whole non-dual trip so convincingly, and it's one of my little, like, one of my
you
little...
You don't buy that.
One of my little... I mean, I can't pretend because it's one of my... What do you call it? It's
not
my set peeve, yeah. Not non-duality, but as it is practiced in Neo-Californian, which is now in parts of India and Europe and all over the place. Good people, but I don't think it's the Advaita Vedanta of Rama Maharshi and Sargadatta Maharaj. And, I mean, all those pictures are there, but check this out. Ramana Maharshi, he got enlightened when he was very young. Great story about that. Everyone's like, well, Ramana, you know, says all I have to do is ask who am I and experience the ground of being. So people go to where he lived. I used to live there in India, in Tiruvannamalai, and you go and ask who am I, and you get these big experiences, and you think you're Ramana Maharshi. If people don't know who he was a great realizer in the last century in southern India. But Ramana had his enlightenment, and then he went into one cave. He was basically, I don't know what he was thinking, but basically along the lines of like, I got to integrate this thing and ground it out. So he went into one cave and spent another 12 or 13 years And then he hiked to another cave, which is about a half a mile away, and spent like another 16 years working out his enlightenment with diligence. And then came down from the mountain and was like, all right, you know, we can start working. You know, like people get, there's enlightenment intensives for a weekend. And it's great to get the experience, but it's all it is. It's beautiful, and it's opening, and it puts us on the path, and it inspires us, in my view, you know, to a life of practice. And the practice is a way of life. So is that distinction clear? At least how I see it. Clear enough. And then there's the body. And this is something I've learned about from my own experience, because I've been teaching about this stuff in university, graduate school, for years, and that's not why I know about it. I know about it because I got slammed. I got slammed with a really bad illness, and the doctors couldn't help me, and I was down for more than 2 years.
What
so
was the illness?
It was undiagnosed or never properly diagnosed. It's an immune thing. While I was ill, I've been teaching mind-body-spirit. I've been teaching mind-body-spirit. I go to a mind-body-spirit festival, you know. and as I look from this side of it, from this side of discovering my body in a different way and healing myself and just learning about the body in a different way, so we've got, like, spirit and psychology, but, like, a lot of the mind-body-spirit is really mind-spirit. And the knowledge of the body is not deeply brought often into spirituality or into psychology, and that's like the body is like, it's kind of like the ultimate litmus test, not like whether you're sick or not sick, because people can get sick for all kinds of reasons, but like that's where it shows up in our practical experience, because we move our bodies and we hold our bodies in different ways and we smile with our bodies and talk with our bodies and so how much to say about the body. I've been studying on my own. I'm doing in-depth studies into yoga studies and somatic psychology, and that's kind of my passion in psychology and psychotherapy right now. And I'm exploring different processes in psychology where you're actually, where you use the body to get into the psyche, and whether it's physically or there's all different techniques. But the difference, it was like the first time I went in for a session as a client for somatic psychotherapy. I'd been working as a therapist for probably 8 or 9 years, and I went into one session with a skilled, very skilled somatic psychotherapist with a spiritual background. And I walked out, and I was like, I can't practice in the same way anymore. I started referring people to him. I was like, I'm okay, but this guy's really got it going on. Because it's all the stuff that we're trying to work on, it's in the mind, but it's stored in the body. And when you work it in the body, the body changes and opens, and the breath changes and the posture changes, and it actually opens up blockages, so that whether you call it prana, life force, all healing energy, which is an incredibly intelligent force, can go about doing its own healing. And I think there's so many ways to do it. I don't think like people have to meditate and go to therapy and do yoga, you know. It's like there's so many ways to do these things, and there's ways that you can work psychologically without a psychotherapist and spiritually without a teacher, and the body but it's helpful to consider it, because not all ways do the same thing. Like when I hike, which I love to do, it doesn't integrate in my body the same way as when I do yoga. So again, we're just like looking at the questions, so that we can make intelligent choices and about our own path. So that's you.
Yeah.
think I want to talk about psychology for a few minutes. I want to read you. No, here's a quote about the body. I just pulled a couple of quotes. I have nice quotes on my computer. They go in the books. It's a quote by somebody will probably have to help me with the last name, Nikos Kazantzakis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Within me, even the most metaphysical problem takes on a warm physical body which smells of sea, soil, and human sweat. The word, in order to touch me, must become warm flesh. Only then do I understand, when I can smell, see, touch. Squeeze, huh? Mm-hmm. Can't forget the jokes. Remind me if I forget. If people get sleepy, then we'll write about the spiritual jokes. But they're funny, so I want to tell them anyway. Are you tired? Okay, this one's for you, Jim. You get first dibs. What do you call a Zen Buddhist monk who has schizophrenia?
I don't know.
You can try. Help Jim. Anyone?
Spumoni.
Okay.
What is a dog?
A man who is at many with the universe. It's almost unpolitically correct somehow. But I don't care. About this one, it's not quite a joke. It's General Custer, is that right? Somebody applied to spiritual practice principles. What is the difference between the egg sandwich and the ham sandwich?
This is according to General Custer.
Yeah.
The difference between the egg sandwich and the ham sandwich.
There's a big difference in the investment between what the chicken invests and what the pig invests.
Smart man. Smart man. You got it. In the egg sandwich, the chicken is involved. In the ham sandwich, the pig is committed. Okay. Are we awake? A little bit about psychology. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who I think was great in spite of all his derelict behavior. This is a bit long. I might read it twice. It's worth taking in. A little bit of that quote on the flyer came from there. It's a piece he wrote that was never published about the charnel grounds, which are, I guess, in Tibetan Buddhism when somebody dies and they place the bodies out on these wide open grounds and then all these vultures and jackals, and there's a whole pecking order, and people come and devour the body. So he's writing about the charnel grounds as a metaphor for working on ourselves, and it's a longer piece, but I picked out a paragraph that I just like so much. As an argument for the need to work in detail and in depth with our own psyche, and not bypass it. The chaos that takes place in your neurosis is the only home ground that you can build the mandala of awakening on. If we are looking for something else, then we want to reject that ground and find a better, higher place. If we are looking for an ideal spot, we never find it. Large areas of our life have been devoted to trying to avoid discovering our own experience. Now we have a chance to explore that large area which exists in our being, which we have been trying to avoid. That seems to be the first message, which may be very grim, but also very exciting. What is happening in the charnel ground is constant personal exploration, and beyond that, just giving, opening, extending yourself completely to the situation that is available to you. Being fantastically exposed and the sense that you could give birth to another world. Mm. So, I don't know, that really moves me. I read it over and over again. I mean, he's basically saying that we have these spiritual experiences and aspirations, but where the work, where we're going to build the ground, the mandala of the awakening of who we are, is in the chaos that exists in our own neurosis, is the only ground. It's not the thing that's in the way, it's the doorway. And that's the difference between Tantra and other perspectives. Like with Tantra, which is not California sex, it's much broader than that. California sex is good, but Tantra is something different, and it's a good moment to explore the difference, because it's not something that's in the way. It's not something that needs to be observed. Come back. It's not something that needs to be observed. I mean, it's not that you just dive into it and indulge, but it's like the chaos that takes place in your neurosis is the tunnel. It is the door. Of course, you've got to walk through that door skillfully. But Tantra uses everything. And I love what he says, when just a continual, constant personal exploration, and beyond that, just giving, opening, extending yourself completely to the situation that is available to you, being fantastically exposed in the sense that you could give birth to another world. Yeah.
I have when I hear things like that, I always go back to my experience with the crippling insane.
Mm.
And
tell us.
I don't think that would be helpful.
Mm.
That approach. The people I was working with are so deranged, and their impulses are so destructive, which is why they ended up where they are.
Right.
And when I read things like Trungpa saying things like that, to me, he's speaking only to a subset of humanity that already is fairly stable, you know, like that already is, to a certain extent, privileged, you know, like so that they won't go off into the kinds of behaviors and mindsets that I experience.
Well, let's just flesh out the territory a little bit more, because, I mean, I don't know what kind of work you did with them. With all of these things, like, they're right... We're talking about the psyche, and it's like it's so multi-layered, and there's things that are actually true in one context that are differently true in another context. Ken Wilber, he calls it state specificity, and it's like he talks about there can be something that's true depending on like in one state of consciousness, and then you move to another state of consciousness up or down, and a different premise applies to the situation. But I'm not so sure about this, because why? Because my friend, let's take for example my friend Kenny, who spoke here a few weeks ago. He gave a great talk. People really loved him. Were some of you here?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool. Kenny's a good friend of mine, and he spent most of his life in jail. And I mean, he deserved to be there. He was a bad dude. He was a bad, bad, bad boy, with as true of a spirit as any of us. And he when he was in prison, he started studying and meditating, and because he just had so much time and getting interested in these things. And then his teacher came into prison, and he had a big awakening experience, which kind of awakened his conscience. And then that begun. See, for me, when I think of Kenny and I know his journey, like that, this is exactly what he did. He begun to explore, like, the chaos of his own neurosis. The awakening happened, but then he had to go in and look at, like, who he was and what he had done and what his motivations were and where he came from, and he had to feel anger and grief and despair and remorse and face things, you know, all the demons and the charnel grounds. And he was in jail like another 3 years, I think, after he had the awakening. And he said in retrospect, he needed it, because he had to work Like he wasn't just like, wow, I'm awakened, and now all that went away. He had a, and I mean, I just talked to him today, like that's the work that one continually does. So I think it would have to be presented extremely skillfully. Again, it's not like any old therapist that's spit out of whatever college who's never had to look at themselves is going to go and say, oh, tell me about the contents of your unconscious and your, you know, taboo fantasies and right? Because that's what you're saying, and you just open all that stuff up and support it as real. And it's not the only thing that's going to work, but I think at some point in somebody's integration process, if they hope to be an embodied, integrated human being or spiritual practitioner, if that's how they identify, that there's going to be work in coming down. If you don't want to just live up, you want to come down. And when people have integrated, they seem to be much more effective in their work in the world. To the degree that we integrate, we seem to be more and more effective, and then people describe people as authentic, and they felt very real and met, and all of these things, like the impression that my friend Kenny made here. Yeah.
Do you think that dreams would be a fundamental door to the chaos of neurosis?
I think they're a great door for people who can get into working that way. Like some people, it's like, oh, I don't remember my dreams, and all that imagery is just not attractive. It's not an avenue that they like. But I think that it's an incredible door, a beautiful door, and you know that one could. You have to study, right? You have to start studying your dreams and learn that it's. Yeah, I do.
Thank you.
I would study that for a lifetime, you know, as well. It's a beautiful door.
You make a distinction between neurosis and psychosis when you say that.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say the same thing. Mm-hmm. Seems like there's a distinction.
Yeah. There's some invisible line that gets crossed, but you, like, when you can, if you're a psychologist, you can feel it. It's like, it's the same spectrum, but when something becomes, like, dysfunctional to a degree that it's like, it hurts oneself and it hurts other people and, you know, I'm just making this particular definition up on the spot, but I know what I see in people. It's like, It's this line that gets crossed, and it's just self and other destructive in a more profound way than, you know, our regular shared neurotic spectrum. Yeah. Do you connect with that, seeing it that way, or is that useful? Maybe.
Did you wish him happy birthday?
Your birthday?
No, Kenny.
I did wish Kenny a happy birthday. He called me to tell me he was 60. That was his reason for not coming. He said it was good. So let's check in. Karma and psychology. I want to touch. Ow! Are these koshas? Okay. I have three things that I want to mention, and then we'll do a little bit more question or discussion, and call it a night. I'll hang out, talk to whoever wants to talk to me. I have one of my friends is a woman in San Rafael called Lama Paulden. She's a Tibetan Buddhist Lama and psychotherapist, and she's a Western Californian, and she helped me understand the connection between karma and psychology, which I found very, very helpful. It's already clear to me that like my psychology, and this is where you go on a meditation retreat, like a 10-day Vipassana retreat or whatever you do, and you start to see how thoughts arise by themselves and you're not thinking them. And it's like, well, why do you have that set of thoughts and you have that set of thoughts, and you see like, oh, this was my mother's, and this is, and you see this in psychotherapy too. But then where did your mother get it? Well, she got it from her mother and her mother and her mother and her mother, and you start taking it back, and the lineage connection becomes becomes very apparent. I mean, anxiety, things can be passed through the womb, they can be passed through the environment, they can be passed in so many different ways from generation to generation. And you take that back far enough, and that's a very simple but practical explanation of karma. Because karma is like, oh, all these lifetimes, like, what did I come into this life with? I came into this life with probably factors I can't imagine, but I also came into this life profoundly influenced by my parents, any of us, and their parents and their parents and their parents and their parents and their parents. And the reason that I like to think of karma that way is because whatever anyone's view of it is, or your belief system about it, it's like whatever all that karma was, how it shows up now, it's available to me. I can work with my karma because it shows up in the form of my own psyche. And it's showing up in my life and the patterns and the contents of my consciousness. So that's a connection that I find very practical and enlivening. It's just like a very simple bridge between psychology and spirituality. Reincarnation, that's like weird and intense, but like you link it. You link, it's not weird, but it's like a lot of people don't resonate with it. But if we just think of it in terms of family lineage, take it far back and then mixing them, dad and mom and teachers and priests and all their karma, and we get all that in, and then we get our little bundle of pleasure and pain to work out with diligence. And another model which helped me to situate psychology. God, I'm feeling like I'm in a transpersonal psychology class because I won a blackboard. In yoga psychology, which I really love because it's more like it's a non-dual psychology, essentially, and I want to mix yoga psychology with Western body stuff. But one of many, many, many models they have in yoga psychology is something that they call the koshas, and it's a model of the seven bodies of the human being. So it's like seven layers of the human body, and the first one is called Anamaya Kosha, and it's like skin, pus, blood. They have these wonderful descriptions. It's like this. And the next level is Pranamaya Kosha, so it's your energy and your prana and your life force. And the next level is Manamaya Kosha, which is basically the lower mind. It's the conditioned mind in psychology. And then there's Vijnaya Maya Kosha, which is a wisdom body, which is like a higher mind, or when we take that lower mind and work and develop. And then we go to Ananda Maya Kosha, which is a bliss body, and like where we go in big non-dual experiences. And then where are we? Ananda Maya Kosha. Atmamaya, there's one more, Chittamaya Kosha, body of consciousness itself. So it's even more than bliss, it's like consciousness void and all and everything body. And those bodies I don't talk about with so much familiarity. And then Atmamaya Kosha, which is like the individuated soul from Atman. So anyway, what I love about this model is that it helped me to situate psychology. It's like it's a third ring. They draw them in rings. And because I don't think psychology is oneness. It's a piece of work that needs to be done. And what happens is that each of those layers kind of include the layer before it. And in order to integrate, the layers before it have to be included. So let's say we have, like, you have your little Manamaya Kosha, like maybe you've had your Anandamaya Kosha developed and these big experiences, and you've even developed wisdom, but in your psychological body there's all kinds of holes. I imagine it kind of like breaks. That's very porous. It's not contained, it's not complete, and it influences. It's like holes in your integration. And so that leads me to the second to last thing I wanted to make sure. No, I think that was the last thing, which is the principle of spiritual bypassing. And some of you might be familiar with this term, and others not. My dear friend, who's an author called John Wellwood, coined this term. He came up with it. He was a student of Trungpa, and many of you probably know the term spiritual materialism, which is when spirituality gets co-opted for material needs. And this is like a subdivision, like a psychological subdivision of spiritual materialism, which is called spiritual bypassing. And John's definition is the use of spiritual ideas and practices to avoid, you know, to bypass or avoid dealing with certain personal or emotional unfinished business, to shore up a shaky sense of self, or to belittle basic needs, feelings, and developmental tasks, all in the name of enlightenment, using spirituality as a way to reject one's experience, to compensate for low self-esteem, social alienation, and emotional problems. Okay, we'll read it again. The use of spiritual ideas and practices to bypass or avoid dealing with certain personal or emotional unfinished business, to shore up a shaky sense of self, or to belittle basic needs, feelings, and developmental tasks, all in the name of enlightenment. Using spirituality as a way to reject one's experience, to compensate for low self-esteem, social alienation, emotional problems. Anyone? Confess? I don't know anybody who I respect who does not fall into the trap of spiritual bypassing. And this is a point that I've played with a lot. And in practical terms, God, there's so many examples. The one that I'm playing with right now, many years ago I published an article in Tricycle called Zen Boyfriends. And it was a little satire on New Age spirituality based on a couple of guys I dated in my early 20s. But basically the principle of spiritual bypassing to make it really practical. And somebody made it into a one-act musical, which I'm going to try to get played here at Spirit Rock. And I hope you'll come if we do. It was so sweet to see it on stage and how people related, because it's us. It's like we'll use anything to like try to squeak out. I mean, we want to face ourselves and we don't want to face ourselves. And I love Gurdjieff, you know, calls it the battle of yes and no. And within every human being, there's constantly like waging this battle between yes and no. And part of us wants to transform, and part of us is like it can't because it's the dynamic of ego. Like ego thinks it's us, and then if we transform, then who I think I am is going to die, and that's perceived as suicide of the ego, and it doesn't want to kill itself. So there's this, but I want to transform, and this is what's going on. Like, I love, you can imagine, it's just in the Hindu thing, they do it like churning the ocean of milk with Vishnu, I think, and the asuras, the angels, the asuras are the bad guys, the dark guys, and the angels, and they're like working this thing out and going back and forth, and Vishnu comes and intervenes with his grace. So anyway, this process is going on, and in that process, like the ego will use anything that it can get its hands on, and then I'm sure everyone here, we're sophisticated and we've practiced and studied. And my ego, I mean, it just does that. It gets like more and more and more clever and sly, and it's so okay, because like that's what an ego does. But if you have to be somebody who's enlightened, then that's going to be a problem, because you're not going to be able to like see that stuff, because your identity is going to get all tied up in being somebody who's enlightened instead of somebody who's, I love that Trump put, just endlessly like in this process of awakening and integration without end. Spiritual bypassing, yeah.
There's a wonderful little clip that's about a minute and a half on YouTube where there's several psychologists talking very negatively about ego, and one of them says, "Ego, that's your worst enemy."
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of that?
In terms of my own personal practice and meditating and working on concepts of the self, I think there's a lot of truth to it.
Mm. But I guess what I'm aware of, I wanted to write a book years ago. Like, it was just called Ego, and like exploring it because right, it's such a loaded word, and also in spiritual world is so misunderstood, and I know that when I first started getting into hardcore spiritual stuff, the first round of stuff I heard is like, ego's the enemy, it must die, you gotta kill the ego and slaughter the ego, and I thought, okay, right, and I started meditating a lot and doing all this stuff, and I think it is our worst enemy, but I think that to develop skillful ways of learning to relate to that enemy, right, like that's the task. And what is Irina Tweedy, the Sufi? She said, ego does not die with laughter and caresses. It must be chased with sorrow and drown in tears. But that I think it's like it's going to be a process of getting to know, getting to know that structure in ourselves and not rejecting it in order to...
Oh, I bet if what you try to do is flat out destroy it, it's going to go hide in a corner somewhere and cause you a lot of problems.
Yeah, or just fight back with a vengeance, and then you become like a spiritual superior, like the kind of person that writes to me all the time. I get this email. People think because you're like a writer that they can just write to you and about whatever judgments and projections and like bandwagon they've got going on that day. And I got this letter the other day, and this guy was, I don't know how he knew me, and he said, your problem is that you've been seeking your whole life, and you have to, you're seeking, your constant seeking is the obstacle, and you just have to, it's all about being here right now, and you have to settle into the now, and you're wasting your time, and going on and on. TMI, as the teens say, too much information. And then it's like, oh, should I respond or not respond? Don't. I appreciate your point. Please go on.
Oh, I was going to say, respond or not respond, there's a reason God created the delete button.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. That's usually the right thing to do sometimes.
This minister that I used to listen to years ago said that in order to diminish your ego, you have to first have a very strong ego. Mm-hmm. You can't be a very weak, indecisive person. You have to develop a strong ego. Mm-hmm. And he says, then you can let go of it and see where you don't need it much anymore.
Yeah.
He says that too.
Yeah. It's a valuable perspective.
How could you possibly let go of the ego? What would do the letting go? Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't understand the ego the same way as others do, but it seems to me that it's our vehicle for interaction with this world that we're in.
Yeah. It's going to be it's going to be about making space in our identification with thinking that the ego is us. I mean, I think that's what this killing the ego thing is supposed to be about, because not only does it keep us alive and functional and able to do everything, but in tantric work, and tantra doesn't just belong to Buddhism, and it belongs to Hinduism and Kabbalah, and that principle, the possibility is that the ego becomes the vehicle. You end up using what you've got and learning how to use it for the divine and use it for your work. A great example of that principle, I used to run these big lecture series where I work at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and I used to just invite all the people that I liked and wanted to meet, and they would make a theme, and people would talk, and I had this woman named Rabina Korten speak, and she's a Tibetan Buddhist nun, Australian. She describes herself, she was a former lesbian Marxist biker chick. A few more things. Angry. This is her self-description. And she met her Buddhist teacher and has been practicing all these years. And then she ended up working in prison, and she teaches Tibetan Buddhism to guys on death row and has a huge prison library project. And this woman is intense. And her ego, I mean, she's not trying to kill her ego or, like, do... I mean, she is full on. So she was giving the talk, and she was basically describing herself, and she's
she was just like, yeah, like I'm angry, and like her anger is about is now converted into like into work with justice, and she said, and I never felt like I belonged anywhere in the world. It's probably something to do with my parents. And she said, and that enables me to like travel all over the world and do my teaching, and then she went on, and she there was all these different things she named about herself, her ego, and how she had basically like the ego work was a shift in identification, so she didn't think it was she could use what she had, and is like big time. And she's a great teacher.
So she's totally identified with the way she is, or seems to be.
No, she knows what she was given. She knows like basically the structure of her psyche. She knows that we're not trying to just become these little spiritual automatons, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm inquiring as to whether she is at choice about her life and the way she moves through life.
Yeah, she's using what she's got. And in process. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she would say, I've got, you know, every rough mm-hmm. edge to continue sanding, but she's using it. Mm-hmm. She's making use of it yeah. for transformation and service and others mm-hmm. because of her practice. I admire that so much. I've been too many places in the world where this like this spiritual automaton and trying to look and act, and it drives me nuts. I can't stand it. And it's like it drives a lot of people nuts. And
you can almost see the gap.
Yeah. What does my friend say? Heart chakra up spirituality or something like that. Yeah, exactly. I'm done my point, so let's just talk for a little while.
I'd like to respond to what Carl was saying earlier. Just in the way that we use our language, there is an indication of multiple separate elements within ourselves that operate at different levels in different ways. You can say something like, my ego. You said two things already. There's the my, there's the ego, and they're working together somehow, or they're working in opposition somehow, depending on what the case may be. So the ego can't be the only thing that's existing within us. There's that my. Mm-hmm. And in all the spiritual work that we do, we're always talking about an annihilation of the self, and there is no self. And I experienced the lack of self. And Laura Dugan's new book has a very nice thing in the beginning of it where she talks about, I am a lawyer, I am angry, I am a parent. What is consistent through all these things? The I. What is the I am as compared to all these other things? And it's, I have an ego. And so there's this play there, this back and forthness, this duality where we're working on getting rid of a duality. So I am getting rid of a duality.
Yeah. I wish I had some. My friend Siddhartha comes and talks here, like these paintings of the Pantheon. I mean, it's like just what you said, and it's painted. It's like Shakti's dancing on Shiva's body, and it's exactly like they're playing it out as in all the forms, that endless forms. Thank you. One or two more comments and then we'll close up and stay for a little while if you want to after that.
I have a comment, but just a request. If you could say a few words about how you see the synthesis of the non-self, the Buddhist non-self, and the self as seen in psychology. Do you have something to say about how
I think that the non-self let me think about it for a moment. It's a great question. It's like if we study Buddhism, we'll see, right? We'll see that there's not actual continuity in the self. There's gaps, and it like arises by itself, and there's a space, and that the self is a construct. I mean, I think probably a lot of us have had that experience, and it's powerful. It's like, well, then how can there be a psyche to work with? And like at the same time, there, in practical terms, there is a psyche. There is a something, even if it arises in between gaps and it's a construct, it keeps arising similarly over and over and over again over many years. there is something that needs attention. And like Jack Kornfield, he has a good story about that, because he was a monk in Burma or wherever he was, and came back all enlightened, and then got into a relationship, and like was immediately like flattened and crazy, and just was like, get me into psychotherapy, and particularly, I think there's like an East-West thing. Like, I would love to be a Sanskrit scholar and a Pali scholar and all those things, so that I would know more about what's happened and like what's lost in translation, because a lot is, and a lot's lost in the cultural. And then there's different variables that are going to be making up an Eastern psyche and a Western psyche. So it's I don't have that information available to me, but I'm sure it would give us important clues. But I guess I can relate to it in a practical way, that if we look at spiritual practitioners and teachers, that I happen to have received over the years, I know just too much, a lot, about all the teachers' personal lives and their relationships and who's been an antidepressant, who's had the breakdowns and what's happened in the scandals and how many women and what age, and, you know, like, people just have been giving me that information for years, and I think I handle it, you know. I'm interested in the principles, but what we see is that there is, in essence, it's no self, and probably at very high degrees of synthesis, different principles would apply. Like, I don't think Bernadette Roberts, a wonderful book, but Journey of No Self, and maybe at certain levels this is not an imminent thing, but I'm just aware that on a very practical level, even for lots and lots of people who are in the role of teacher, this work ends up working with oneself psychologically, whether in therapy again or not, ends up being really, really important. And such catastrophes and some major spiritual communities that when it's not done, and these, I know that these teachers, like, they can articulate non-dual principles, not just articulate it, but consistently over 20 years, and they write it, and I'm sure when they meditate they experience it, and they're running horrible things on their students, really outright. I mean, I've got a wide space for things, crazy wisdom and this and that, but like outright abuse, and so it's like there's no self, and their like self that arose within no self needs attention.
There's a self somewhere.
Something needs attention, and it's not, again, like any old psychotherapist will do, but intelligent, like, psychotherapy in a spiritual context, or just sometimes it can be feedback from one's peers at those levels, and people don't always, they're not willing to actually be open to feedback in a real way where they would take it in and maybe do something about it. It's kind of a tragedy, but I guess we're just in process as we're working spiritual culture and importing traditions and working out East and West and these things that we're in. Yeah.
And Democrat and Republican. I mean, I'm just, mm-hmm. I keep being brought back to something, mm-hmm. I heard yesterday. I think it was Rudolph, was it Giuliani? Giuliani, thank you.
Giuliani, that was what?
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, cool. I mean, I got stuck with that, Jim. But it was really the idea. It was just, this is just a concept, and I don't mean to open this up for discussion. But it's just, and I think that this discussion that that I've been hearing tonight kind of opens me up to this. I mean, mm-hmm. I think I'm comfortable in my singular development, in the context of a more integrated being. But mm-hmm. when I hear things like, we need to drill offshore, I'm not talking about energy or the abundance of what may lie, or peak oil, but it's, why do people chant? Why does this mass group of body chant, drill, baby, drill, drill, baby, drill? And so I was thinking mm-hmm. about some of the things, I talked about your holes of integration mm-hmm. and spiritual bypassing, and, and it's just, but it's the context of the world that I live in. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I'm not whacked out about it, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I hear that, and mm-hmm. I'm saying, well, how do I, what part of me is, involved in that chant? And what part of me can actually observe that and kind of ask the question, mm-hmm. just ask the question, why is that chant going on? And mm-hmm. what does it mean? I mean, mm-hmm. it's beyond the energy requirements. It's something else going on, and I don't know what it is. And maybe I won't, even mm-hmm. continue to want to figure it out, but it was just something that just happened yesterday. And so, it's just a question, and it's just an observation.
Yeah, thank you. I don't have anything, but I appreciate you bringing that piece in.
Yeah, because it's a reality.
I made me think of a beautiful little story, and I think we should close up to respect the time in the store, but then we can chat a little bit more if we need to afterwards.
What about the jokes?
I told them.
Oh, you told them all.
I have more. But they get cheesier and longer. And they're still spiritual, but I have to dig in my memory bank besides all the Buddha hot dog things, which I'm bored of. Okay, we'll do the Buddha hot dogs. Some of you probably know this one. What did the Buddhist monk say to the hot dog vendor?
Make me one with everything.
Oh, cute.
Then the Buddhist, so the hot dog vendor, the monk gave the hot dog vendor a $20 bill, and then he wasn't giving him any change, so the monk was like, hey, where's my change? And the hot dog vendor says, I thought change comes from within. I have been unpacking my new house for a week. Why does the Buddha have difficulty vacuuming the sofa, like underneath?
It doesn't have any attachments.
Right on. Let's end with that. Thank you for being here. I'll stick around for a little while.